National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What happens when a city built for 2 million people sees its population sink by more than half? How does a city maintain services when its property taxes drop by 65%? That's the dilemma faced by the city of Detroit. How Detroit responds to these challenges holds valuable lessons for cities everywhere. With us to talk about these challenges is Wayne State Professor Robin Boyle. We'll also talk to Dick Rigby about the move to in-town living. He is co-author of a new book of the same name by Island Press. But first, National Geographic Traveler editor Keith Bellows tells us why he loves L.A. and why we should too. That's all today on Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Keith Bellows is editor of one of my favorite magazines, National Geographic Traveler, and he's come up with 30 reasons to love the City of Angels, Los Angeles. Keith, Los Angeles is grabbing a lot of national attention now with the election of its new mayor. Besides Mayor Villaraigosa, what's to love about Los Angeles?
Well, you know, I think Los Angeles is one of those cities that isn't really a city. My wife and I argue about this a lot. She used to cover entertainment for Entertainment Weekly out there. And she's, you know, a diehard believer that Los Angeles is a city. I actually think it's a collection of cities, which makes it a particularly fascinating place because, you know, Santa Monica is different than Malibu, is different than Hollywood, it's different than Beverly Hills. And so you've got a lot of sort of microcosms of culture and sort of citification.
I have to agree with you, but that makes it a little tough for the visitor. I mean, how do you take it all in? Where do you begin?
You know, it is a tough town because, first of all, you pretty much have to get a car, and you spend a lot of time going from here to there. I tend to, when I go there, and I've spent a lot of time there, I either plunk down in Santa Monica, which is right on the water, or I go to Beverly Hills, and I don't try to do the entire city. You know, it obviously depends on how much time you have there, but any given part, and I particularly like Santa Monica because you get a little bit of best of both worlds. You've got the ocean culture, you know, Venice Beach isn't far away, Melrose is there for shopping, great hotel, the Shutters, which is my sort of personal favorite, is where you always see Robert Duvall with these pretty young things hanging out in the lobby.
Are they tangoing?
No, actually not the last time I saw them in there. They were buying stuff, but I'm sure they tango at times.
Well, I'm curious, are there must-sees in Los Angeles if you've never done the city before?
Well, yeah, you certainly have to do Hollywood. And Hollywood, when you get around the Grauman's Chinese Theater and so forth, it's an icon. And quite frankly, 10, 15 years ago, it was a real eyesore. It was very much down at the heels. It's been refurbished. The theater has actually been refurbished. So you have to spend some time there. I know it's really, really a cliche, but doing the Stars homes is a lot of fun. You know, that's why you go to Los Angeles, is because you do see stars. I mean, you see them no matter where. I like Topanga Canyon. I used to hang out there in the 70s. This is where, you know, guys, you know, Neil Young used to have a place there. The Fleetwood Mac used to have a place there. It's a very sort of hippy-dippy area of town, but it's absolutely gorgeous. Great restaurant there called Inn of the Seventh Ray, which is a little cosmic, we say in the magazine. You got to do Venice. You got to do the boardwalk in Venice. And Venice Beach is very cool. This is where Jim Morrison used to hang out. And they actually have canals there. Chinatown, it's got a very vibrant Chinatown. It's got a terrific Koreatown, and one of the things we point out in the magazine is that if you go to Koreatown, check out the karaoke. It's a big deal there. Santa Monica Mountains is gorgeous. Malibu is a personal favorite. You drive up Route 1, and it's right there. It's a little hard to see the stars there, but the territory, the whole area is absolutely gorgeous.
Well, the photographs that you used to illustrate Insiders Los Angeles in your July-August issue are just fabulous. They just make you want to get away this weekend and hit Los Angeles.
Well, you know, it's really tough to capture a city pictorially. And what we tend to do, what we do do with these insider's guides is we send a photographer and they spend 2 weeks. And their goal is to not only get a sense of the ambience of a city, but also the people, the quality of the people, the quirkiness, the sights and sounds, the sights and scenes, but also sort of what it is that gives the town its character. And Los Angeles, of course, is perfect that way, because one of the things our photographers told us when they came back was like, this is the only city I've shot where every single time, whether it be a restaurant or, a street scene, I'm focusing on the shot, and everybody in the scene, whether in the background or the foreground, is mugging the camera and trying to get in the shot. They can't help themselves in Los Angeles.
I have a theory about Los Angeles, too. I think at one point, and probably still today, pretty people move to Los Angeles thinking they're going to be in the movies or television or whatever. And then they marry each other, and then they procreate, and they have even prettier children. So there is the biggest collection of pretty people.
I can't beat that theory. I think there's a lot of truth there. There's certainly no question that every, waiter and waitress you encounter, no matter if it's a high-end restaurant or a low-end restaurant, they're working the scene in terms of trying to get a screen test, get their script sold, get a bit part in a B-movie or in a commercial. It's the culture there.
Yeah, well,
one of the things that's great about Los Angeles, especially the retail space, if you go in some of the areas around town, a lot of the stars sort of, they wear something once and then they send it to the secondhand stores. So places like Melrose, you really can get some absolute gems, some great deals. I once saw Drew Barrymore coming into a store that I was standing in, and she had four boxes full of what looked to me like brand new shoes, Manolos and tons of dresses, and she just was like turning them over.
Ooh. Well, something that I like in Los Angeles is the market. And you forget that Los Angeles is sitting in California, which is a lot of farms. So the very fresh food and that's sort of a fun place to hang out.
Absolutely. I mean, even in Hollywood, there's a Sunday morning market, which is terrific. There's a Wednesday morning market in Santa Monica, which is great. And there's no question, you just don't find produce like you find in these markets. It's just incredible stuff.
Keith Bellows is editor of National Geographic Traveler. You're listening to Smart City. Robin Boyle is Associate Director of the College of Urban Labor and Metropolitan Affairs and Professor of Urban Planning at Wayne State University in the heart of Detroit, Michigan. It is the only college in the U.S. that integrates urban labor and workplace issues in one place. A native of Glasgow, Scotland, Professor Boyle moved to the U.S. in 1992. His ongoing research includes school planning, school size, and the challenge of adaptive reuse of older school buildings, investment patterns in residential and retail development, and the issue of vacant land in central cities. Last year, he was elected to the planning board for the city of Birmingham, Washington. Robin, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
You work in one of America's most interesting but most challenged cities. Give me a quick overview of the city of Detroit.
The city of Detroit is an interesting place, but it's a place that has changed quite dramatically. Let me give you just an overview. In 1960, there were almost 2 million, or 1.8 million people roughly, living in the central city. That's not the suburbs. This is the city as a whole. Today, there's probably just over 900,000. So we're looking at basically a 50% drop in the number of people living in the city of Detroit. Similarly, the number of jobs have fallen by the same amount. In 1960, there were almost 650,000 jobs, people working in jobs in the city of Detroit. Today, the estimates are there's maybe 300,000 jobs in the city of Detroit. So this is a city that has really seen dramatic population decline. And yet, the city as a whole remains the same size. The land area of the city, and this is a big city, 138 square miles, is the same as it was in 1960. So the fundamental question is, what do you do with all the space that is here in the city of Detroit?
Tell me why so many people left Detroit.
Gosh, it's a long story, but let me try and simplify it. First off, the geography of Southeast Michigan is one that allowed residential development, housing to be developed relatively easily in the suburbs, moving in a north and westerly direction from the Detroit River. So in the 1930s and into the 1940s, supported by, as we know, federal subsidies, the population began to seek the American dream. A single-family home on a nice lot, sometimes by a lake, often by a forest. This was what was able to be driven by a very booming economy. The Detroit economy wasn't just the automobile industry. The Second World War had a huge impact on increasing incomes in the metropolitan area in the 1930s and the 40s into the 50s. Therefore, we saw single-family housing developing all over the suburban area. Into the 1960s, it continued apace. The freeways were built because of the pressure, and we therefore had a physical ability to move people out, but still bring them back for their jobs in the central city. What really changed, however, in the late 60s, was the impact of the riots or the disturbances, whatever term you want, which changed the nature of suburban migration. We saw the beginning then of white flight, the movement out, the separation of Southeast Michigan into an effectively black central city and an increasingly white suburban area. That stemmed from the very serious riots of 1967, but continued through the 70s and the 80s. And what really changed then was that the jobs moved. Instead of it being a suburban residential area with people commuting into the central city, the jobs began to move out very quickly. And we therefore saw the development of the egg cities, the Southfields, then the Troys, and then even further out, meaning that the powerhouse of the city was now spread across a very large metropolitan area, leaving a weakened, emptying, blacker central city.
And with that condition, Robin, what's to be done?
Well, that's the really important question. As I said before, we've seen a hemorrhaging of people and jobs from the central city. But the central city itself, the city of Detroit, remains the same size, 138 square miles. Or for those who like acres, 88,000 acres. This is a very big place. And can I just say, it's a big place because in the first three, four decades of the 20th century, people lived in single-family homes in Detroit. This is not like Baltimore or Philadelphia with its row houses or its tenements as in New York. This is a city effectively of owner-occupied single-family homes with a yard front and back and a garage for your car. That is what was fueled by this economy. This is what the real estate development was in the 20th century. And as the city has emptied out, we've seen more and more and more of these houses falling into disrepair. We're not actually sure how many vacancies we've got, but let's say we've got probably 45,000 to 50,000 abandoned units, vacant sites. It's a monumental task just keeping a handle on what we've got. So now we have a city that is dotted with some neighbourhoods that are intact, and there are some strong neighbourhoods. But they are separated by acre after acre after acre of a city that doesn't do anything, of derelict homes, of vacant sites. Some people call it the prairie in Detroit, because that's what it's like. We have lots of areas that have nothing going on. But the problem is that for each of these areas, there are roads, there are sidewalks, there's lights, there's an infrastructure of power, gas lines, electrical lines that crisscross all of the 88,000 acres. That has to be maintained, but maintained by a city that is half its size. Let me give you one statistic that I find devastating. In 1960, and I'm basing this on the year $2,000, the city brought in roughly $700 million in property taxes. By the year 2000, property taxes coming into the city using the same dollars at the year 2000, they brought in $213 million, a drop of 69%. The city of Detroit today brings in 12% from property tax. Now that is off the chart, and I mean the bottom of the chart, as compared to almost any other city in the United States of America. Property taxes now make up an eighth of the income of the city of Detroit. In many places, it's two-thirds of the city's of a city's income. There you have a fundamental problem. You have a physical geography of 88,000 square miles that has to be maintained. the lots to be cleared, the roads to be maintained, the services to be provided, etc. 88,000 square miles with half the number of people, and yet an income base that has dropped by 69%.
Okay, that you've done the job of dramatically characterizing the state of Detroit today. So let me ask you for some solutions, Robin. First of all, you told me that there were 20,000 blocks, 20,000 blocks in Detroit that are either abandoned or seriously dilapidated, beyond repair. So, you know, how could you imaginatively rethink the shape, the geography of Detroit and reuse of those 20,000 blocks? It's highly unlikely that you're going to turn the population trends around in a way that could productively use those 20,000 blocks. So what are your options?
This is one of the fundamental policy challenges facing the city fathers and mothers and all the decision makers and the stakeholders in the city of Detroit. Let me go back a bit. There's a mentality of growth. There's a fundamental mentality that says places will come back. This is the American way. Growth is paramount. And therefore, if we just get the conditions right, we make everything click. It's like a jigsaw puzzle. If we can get the different parts of the jigsaw puzzle, we can put the picture back together. And that is what has driven urban change in North America, and indeed in most of the world, for the past two centuries. But I think there is a fundamental change in some places, and Detroit is at the forefront of this. There just simply isn't the mechanism, there isn't the engine to fill all the spaces. So I think a fundamental choice has got to be made. And that choice is really about selecting those parts of this 138 square miles or 88,000 acres, as I said before, making some hard strategic choices that will allow the city, the state, and even the nation to focus its attention on certain parts of a place like Detroit. And there are, as I said before, some strong, vibrant neighbourhoods. But the question is, what do you do with the other parts? And there I think we need to have a completely different approach. We need to change our mindset that these areas will not redevelop within 10 years. They won't redevelop in a generation. It may take two generations, if at all, for these places to come back. And I think what we have to do is come up with a model that takes these areas out of commission. And I don't just mean walking away from the sidewalk or not maintaining a particular park. I mean removing the services, rerouting them, perhaps closing whole swathes of streets because we can't afford to run them, and allowing these places to in effect revert to some quasi-natural condition. Now, what can one do with that land? Well, leave it fallow, which is a standard agricultural approach. We could address issues of, for example, urban farming on a large scale. And I don't just mean gardening. I mean, for example, urban forestry, taking out large areas and considering in the long run the opportunities that we might have for producing urban forestry that would provide trees for development in other parts of Southeast Michigan or even elsewhere. Secondly, people have talked about bringing traditional agriculture back into the city. That is possible. There are ways to do it. It would take an enormous amount of effort to clear land and to bring the soil conditions back. But this is one of the richest areas in terms of soil conditions in the Southeast Michigan area, and therefore there is a possibility there. A third model, and one that's often talked about, but there's a problem, and that is creating major park space. Parks are very important for cities. They always have been, and they will be. The downside is how do you pay for a park? It's all very well to look to models where the community can take over a park, the famous examples of New York City and elsewhere. But when you have a declining population and a poor population at that, it's tough to know how the parks are going to work. That's when you require higher level intervention, whether it's from the counties, the state or even the federal government that would perhaps take on this very difficult task of managing the land that won't be built up over the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
Robin, is this an active discussion in Detroit?
No. It is not an active discussion. A little story. Almost, 10 years ago, it was an active discussion. There was a city employee, Marie Farrell Donaldson, came up with a discussion similar to what you just heard me present. And I'm afraid she was shot down in flames. She was criticised for arguing that Detroit is going in the wrong direction, and that she was criticised by not being in favour and in support of the city. So there's one example of how when somebody did raise this model 10 years ago, the discussion was pushed to one side. We continually have a debate or a discussion that seeks to wait to find ways to, as I say, fill all the acres, all 88,000 of them. And I just think it's untenable. Unfortunately, we are driven by a four-year mayoral cycle, or the cycle of elections for city council or for the election for governor or whatever it is, that is short term. And it is very difficult for politicians in office or aspirant politicians to make this debate, because you know, it's challenging the very basis of what we think cities are about. So I think it's going to take an enormous change in mindset, leadership, courage from people to stand up and say, hold it, we have got to think of a different way for a place like the city of Detroit.
There are, as you say, the growth advocates, fill the blocks advocates in Detroit. Tell me, what are the assets of the city that can be used to leverage economic development?
One of our principal assets is, of course, the river. The river does a number of things. One, it provides a wonderful physical environment. Cities on water all over the world are the strongest cities. San Antonio, there's an ironic comment, isn't it? A city that has just overtaken Detroit in population terms, beating us in basketball, has reconstructed itself along that river walk. We have a much better river than that. We have the Detroit River, which is a superb asset for the city. And indeed, the city is turning itself towards the river, as in many places we turned away from it. Today, we're turning towards it with a new river walk, with a riverfront conservancy, with a lot of development occurring. Well, let me put that into context. Some development occurring along the river. The river is also our international boundary. We face Canada. There is incredible economic benefit from being on this river, on this boundary, with the flow of goods and services coming across. And again, there are moves afoot to capitalize on that asset. So there's one very, very powerful asset. Another asset, of course, is the fact that we've got real estate. We have got very good communications. We have got a highway system, freeway system, second to none because of the investment in the past. We should be capitalizing on that. Thirdly, we've also got some very strong historic neighborhoods. These are the places, in my opinion, that we can start to focus attention, target the developers, target the resources, begin to focus expenditures on schools and services and social services, healthcare, around a series of, if you want, urban villages. It's a hackneyed term, but why not? It's worked in the past. It can work in the future. My vision for, and other people's vision for, the city of Detroit is to reconstruct this place around these nodes of opportunity, these strong villages that do exist.
You mentioned the historic neighborhoods, Robin. I was stunned by Detroit's architectural traditions. Of course, much of it is in a state of disrepair, but you're beginning to see some really interesting conversions of historic buildings to residential in downtown Detroit. Is that movement gaining any momentum?
In the downtown, it is. The trick, one of the important questions will be, can we take this experience that we've got of adaptive reuse in the downtown area and move it into, as I said before, these important potential villages? I can take you almost along many, many streets in Detroit, and you get to the major junctions where the diagonal streets superimposed on the grid create very interesting, very opportunistic centres where the roads come together. There's often the school, a couple of churches, a commercial strip, perhaps an old three or four storey commercial building with retail on the ground floor, much of it derelict. But there's a sense of a physical legacy, a heritage, a patrimony, as the term is often used in the historic preservation industry. Build around these, start to focus attention on them, and then I think we can start to see these villages come together. Having said that, I wouldn't want that discussion to deflect from the bigger issue that I described before as to what do we do with the acres and acres and acres that are not required. But you're absolutely right. If we can get the techniques that have helped in some respects adaptive reuse in the downtown, let's move that into some of these neighbourhoods in other parts of the city.
One technique that a number of cities have thought would help their economy was the approval of casinos. Detroit has done that. Detroit has a number of casinos. You've studied their impact. What is it?
Positive. A number of people thought that the sky would fall when casinos would come into the city of Detroit. I would argue that they haven't. A good example of adaptive reuse. Three casinos operating in the city of Detroit. Two of them are in genuinely adapted buildings. One was a bread factory, a bakery. Another one, believe it or not, was in a tax office. They attract tens of thousands of visitors into their casinos. I wouldn't say they attract them into the city of Detroit because they tend to come in and spend their money within the casino. But another statistic that is important is they employ about 7,500 people. They provide reasonably well-paying jobs to people in the city of Detroit who would have to, as I said before, drive out of the city to find equivalent jobs. But even more importantly, as I said before, the property tax base of the city has fallen, and in its place has come other taxes, and one, a really important one, is the wagering tax that comes into the city through these casinos. Over $100 million a year from these three casinos. On the other side of the chart, people said, oh, the crime will increase, there'll be a lot of pathological, psychological issues, and they may exist. The evidence is that it's small scale, however, and there hasn't been an increase in crime close to these casinos. And indeed, in addition to the wagering tax, the casinos themselves pay services for additional emergency services, policing in and around the casinos. And to date, there hasn't been an increase in problems.
We've often talked on the show about the value of stadia and arenas to cities. Do you think it is at all symbolic or demoralizing that the Detroit Pistons don't, in fact, play in the city of Detroit?
That's an interesting question. One would imagine that it would be. But of all the sports, I would say when you go to Auburn Hills, which is, I don't know, 28 miles north of the city of Detroit, you see a genuinely mixed audience. This is an example. When the Pistons are playing in Auburn Hills, you're looking at a genuinely integrated population that is looking at this sport being played, more so, I would say, than when you go to the downtown stadiums, ironically, for the new stadiums that were built for football and certainly for baseball. The two stadiums that have been built downtown are symbolic of change. They're very attractive. They attract reasonably good crowds when the teams are playing well. But again, there isn't a great deal of bleeding out. There isn't a great deal of spin-off from these stadiums. As you know, football only played, 12 times a year or so, if you're lucky. And you don't get a great deal of spin-off from them. There's a bit more from the baseball. I was there on Saturday night, and it was great to see all the crowds there. And, 38,000 people showed up downtown Detroit to watch the Tigers. And there was some evidence of, as I say, the multiplier operating. But we need a great deal more of that, and that's going to take a long time to come.
If you were in charge, Robin, of Detroit's civic future, where would you begin to strengthen and rebuild the city?
I think I'd probably start by trying to build a dialogue that would connect the residents and the stakeholders in the city of Detroit with the mechanisms of change. And the mechanisms of change are in the private sector for the major companies in Southeast Michigan, with the state of Michigan, and indeed perhaps with those who want to listen in federal government, to really address the question of where the city is going to go in the long term. Try and get away from that four-year cycle of build and bust, in our case, try and get as much as we can in a short period of time. Try and get away from that through a dialogue that would connect those who are resident here, those who have investments here, with others who can see the long run. And try and get a discussion going about how we can get this focus of investment in particular areas, and also see the potential for doing something with all of these acres that are currently just lying, doing nothing in the city of Detroit.
You have a mayoral election this year. What's the outlook?
Challenging. We have three, four candidates who look as though they're going to go into the runoff in August. I think Mayor Kilpatrick will probably go through into the final competition in November. Who is his challenger going to be? I won't stick my neck out too far. But really, does it make a difference? At the end of the day, there are still going to be enormous problems for whoever wins. I'm asking them, and a number of people are, in the city of Detroit, to take a different approach, to try and think of different ways of moving ahead in such a way that we can reconnect the city of Detroit to the suburban area, to make the central city once again a powerhouse within Southeast Michigan, which it clearly is not at present. It's a drag on Southeast Michigan. We are suffering here, particularly in this part of the state, because I think we have such a weak central city. And if we want the state to come back, if we want the Midwest to be strong, then I think the city of Detroit has got to be strong. And the only way to do that is to think in the long term.
Robin, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City and talking about Detroit.
Thank you for inviting me to come along today.
Robin Boyle is Associate Professor of the College of Urban Labor and Metropolitan Affairs and Professor of Urban Planning at Wayne State University. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the growing cost of stadiums. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Dick Rigby about in-town living. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, we have a perennial discussion on Smart City about the value of stadiums and professional sports to cities. And you found a study in the Indianapolis Star that says small cities in particular are paying dearly for their sports teams.
Yeah, you know, the professional sports stadiums are controversial everywhere because, you know, I mean, what we're doing is we're asking taxpayers to subsidize millionaires who are playing on teams owned by billionaires, and that just doesn't strike many taxpayers as something their tax money ought to be spent on. I guess the only good news here is if you live in a big city, at least you're going to be asked to pay less of the full freight than if you're in a small city. The Indianapolis Star, the newspaper in Indianapolis, looked at the 10 most recent NFL stadium deals, just the National Football League stadium deals, and compared the amount that the five largest of those 10 paid as a percent of the taxpayers paid as a percent of the entire cost of the stadium and those that were paid by the five smallest cities in the 10. And what they found, interestingly enough, was that the larger cities, on average, paid about 45% of the cost of building stadium. In other words, the team or some other entity paid for the other 55%. In the five smallest cities, the taxpayers paid about 80% of the cost of the stadium. Now, in Indianapolis, they're very sensitive about this because when you cut through all the sort of deliberate obfuscation of what the city is actually paying for its new football stadium, it's going to end up paying about 92% of the cost of that football stadium. And in Cincinnati, they have an even a worse deal where they're paying 94%. And, of course, this is sort of terrible politics, and it's really gotten people upset in these two places.
Well, it all comes back to how do you value professional sports.
Yeah, and the smaller places, no, they don't have much leverage when it comes to their teams because they are small markets. They could move somewhere bigger, and the one they always sort of drag out is, you know, Los Angeles does not have a professional football team, so Indianapolis or Cincinnati, if you want to keep your team, you don't want it to go to Los Angeles, you better pay up.
Otis, I was watching the NBA playoffs and learned that the Pistons started in Fort Wayne.
Yeah, they move around quite a bit. The Hawks here in Atlanta, where I am, were in St. Louis before they came here. So teams do move around quite a bit. And as you may remember, the Atlanta Braves were originally the Milwaukee Braves, and before that, the Boston Braves. So we have a long tradition of teams moving around. They're footloose.
Well, I don't know how to value it in economic terms, but I do love my NBA, so here's one happy citizen. Otis,
okay,
we'll talk to you.
We'll put you down in the for the subsidy
for the 94% subsidy category. Okay, we'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Okay, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Dick Rigby is co-director of the Washington, D.C.-based Waterfront Center. It's a nonprofit research and education organization founded in 1981 to promote best practices in redeveloping urban waterfront resources. With his partner, Ann Breen, he is co-author of the new book, In Town Living, A Different American Dream, published by Island Press. Dick, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
In the past 10 years, you've seen a burst of in-town living, even in the most unlikely cities. Why the sudden interest in living downtown and in-town?
Well, my partner, Ann Breen, and I did the research that produced the in-town living title that we're talking about. And in the course of it, we found two groups fueling the in-town living phenomenon, namely young people, people under 40, and gay of any age. And they are simply not interested in the subdivision kind of lifestyle that is our predominant pattern of living in this country. It doesn't feature the kinds of things that these two groups are interested in.
What distinguishes in-town living from what's been sold as the American dream, the suburban single-family detached home with the two-car garage?
Two-car garage, yeah. Right. Well, you know, a predominant form is the loft, and people are marketing anything and everything as a loft today. It can be a townhouse, it can be an apartment tower, but it's much more dense, is a major characteristic in the physical form. It is quite distinct from the single family detached a house with a garage often in front. That's called a snout house in some places.
You mentioned three groups that you found predominant in in-town living: young people, gays, and divorced people.
Also weekenders.
Weekenders, yeah. And I would assume that while those people have led the move toward in-town living, they are simply leading the pack, because now it seems that you're beginning to see a lot of empty nesters moving downtown.
I believe that is the pattern. That is, the groups that we identified are in the pioneering areas. They lead the way. And they effectively make it safe, and they will stabilize and populate that neighborhood. And I think you will in time have empty nesters, in fact, attracted to it. You move to the suburbs ostensibly for your children. So the children leave. You're in a three-bedroom house, two people rattling around. It makes eminent good sense to sell that and move on in. But we expected to find a lot of this happening, and in our pioneering cities, it wasn't, because it's still too new.
Tell me which cities you studied.
We studied Atlanta, Dallas, and Houston, and I would think these would fit into most people's definitions of places where it would be unlikely to find in-town, lively in-town neighborhoods. We studied New Orleans and Memphis and Minneapolis and Portland, Oregon, plus Vancouver. New Orleans, Minneapolis, Portland, and Vancouver, they're a little different in that they had precedents in each of those cities for in-town neighborhoods, such as the French Quarter or the Garden District in New Orleans. But what we looked at was another area, the warehouse area, where nobody except derelicts was present two decades ago. And likewise in Vancouver, there's been a population in the downtown since the turn of the century. But the area we looked at had nobody. It was the expo site. It had been purchased by the government, leveled, and made over for the fair. The fair's over, and nobody's there. So it's been transformed. It's our most dramatic transformation, with high-rise towers popping up all over the place.
What did you find that the in-town living had in common from city to city?
Some surprising, to us, surprising things. One is the importance of a grocery store. And another was the importance in a negative sense of a panhandling. We spent years in D.C. In town and are used to panhandling. So it was a bit of a surprise to us how much attention was given to this in these new areas. That is, we're looking at pioneering cities or pioneering areas within cities with downtown neighborhoods. And likewise, a grocery store, that was a bit of a surprise to us, and I'll use Vancouver again as an example. When the first towers went up and you had your first people settling in this Falls Creek neighborhood, there was no grocery. And as a consequence, there was very little street life. And an urban-style grocery cafe opened up, and suddenly the streets sprang to life, and people would stop off in the morning for coffee on their way to work, and it just became the effective neighborhood center.
What did you find different among the cities you studied?
Well, that's a good question. All of the cities had one degree or another of incentives involved, but some were more aggressive, I think might be the word, in promoting it. This would affect the pace at which the in-town settlement would come. In two of the cities, you had World Fair type events as triggers. That's Vancouver and New Orleans. The warehouse area I described earlier as being derelict. With the World Fair in 84, there was a major investment involved and some cleanup. And the people in New Orleans discovered they had a warehouse district. They did not know it. And it was an eye-opener, and they saw the classic brick warehouse structures, and a few of them had the imagination to see what could happen.
Did you see, Dick, any mistakes being repeated from city to city in terms of attempting to develop in-town and downtown neighborhoods?
Traffic and parking are the bugaboos, and it takes a great deal of municipal will to address these. Most cities have a suburban parking standard that's inappropriate, and it's very hard for them to wean themselves from it. And likewise, the emphasis in traffic engineering is to move the cars through the cities as rapidly as possible. Well, both of these standards conflict with the objective of having in-town residential neighborhood thriving. Houston, not surprisingly, is probably at the head of the list in making these mistakes. I mean, its central business district is just laced with surface parking. And likewise, their street pattern is they have one-way streets, and the traffic flows through there rapidly. And that's good for the people in the car, but if you're on the street, it's uncomfortable walking.
You mentioned the importance of a grocery store. You mentioned the focus on panhandling and getting rid of it. In your opinion, are there other key amenities or basic services that, if provided, would accelerate the in-town living trend even further?
Yes. Neighborhood-style restaurants, as distinct from high-end or magnet restaurants. And I'll use Midtown Atlanta as an example here, where initially, the restaurateurs thought that high-end and, say, glamorous facilities were what was sought to you know, work in with this new population. What the people are really looking for is a neighborhood place with good food and inexpensively provided that they can return to. Not to say you can't have a glamorous restaurant or two or three, but they really want a casual place to frequent.
Among the cities you studied, Dick, which was your favorite?
I'm going to give you two answers. New Orleans is, I think, Anne's and my favorite North American city. But the other answer is Vancouver. In terms of the subject area of our research, it's the most dramatic transformation, both physically and in the population that is assembling there. I think when we left off, they had built 37 high-rise towers on their way to some 60 planned. And the things are sold out before the dirt's stirred. It's just an amazing influx. Having said all that, New Orleans is our favorite city. It has a funkiness to it and a vitality and a mix of race and culture and creativity. And I have to say, it's a relatively poor city, but it has a vitality that is infectious.
Where do you think this movement is headed? Will we continue to see more in-town living, or do you think the interest is cyclical?
Well, my short answer would be yes, but you have to have a cautionary note. The predominant lifestyle remains and will remain way past suburban. I use the phrase subdivision as more descriptive because you have some older suburbs that are quite urban in character, but you have the fastest growing areas in the country out in Arizona and Nevada, and you're talking about populating the desert. And these are centerless places with 100,000 people or more. So that's going on. And there is, of course, this reaction to this facelessness. And that is where people are seeking character. And that's behind the in-town phenomenon. I think it's going to grow because it feeds on itself. So, yes, I would think the trend is going to accelerate even.
The book is In Town Living, A Different American Dream. Dick, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Dick Rigby is co-director of the Waterfront Center and co-author of In Town Living, A Different American Dream. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City Views commentator Walker Smith says it's not enough anymore for us to like the places we live and the things we buy. Instead, these things must reinforce our dreams and aspirations.
Nowadays, we want the stuff we buy to connect us with the non-material values that have come to matter most to us. One place to see this combination of tangibles and intangibles is in the pages of Real Simple magazine. Real Simple is filled with aspirational images of lifestyles that show off these new values in comfortable, even luxurious ways. No sacrifice, frugality, or privation. Real Simple does not picture simplicity. It shows people who are in control and thus able to enjoy a life filled with more than just things. The success of Real Simple magazine is a testament to the fact that we will shop with extra enthusiasm when the marketplace better matches our dreams and aspirations. Of course, it's not as if quality, intangibles, and time have ever been unimportant to us. The difference now is that these values have become dominant. Several marketplace observers have noted this change in our core values. Consultants Joseph Pine and James Gilmore were the first to outline a business model to fit this shift in values in their 1999 book, The Experience Economy. Their now classic example of birthday cakes illustrates the progression in the marketplace culminating in today's experience economy. We have gone from birthday cakes baked from scratch, to cakes made from a mix, to cakes bought to go, to businesses that put on the whole party. The cutting edge of growth lies in providing consumer experiences. More recently, consultants Michael Silverstein and Neil Fisk focused on the business implications of consumer expectations of luxury and prosperity. In their 2003 book, Trading Up, they examined the marketing implications of an increasingly affordable and ubiquitous luxury. Brands can no longer leverage quality and indulgence to their advantage because luxury has become a cost of entry in many categories. Instead, marketers must start with luxury and then add a strong emotional edge for differentiation. If this doesn't resonate with you, think of it as the new JetBlue economy. Leather seats and 24-channel TVs at discount fares. In other words, material luxury is taken for granted. It doesn't command a premium, which is why Target is the epitome of chic and Costco is the place to go for high-end wines. In her 2003 book, The Substance of Style, economist and New York Times columnist Virginia Postrel zeroes in on design, aesthetics, and glamour as the new driving forces in the marketplace and society at large. Aesthetics invests things with the meaning for which people are willing to pay. Whether it's experiences, emotions, or aesthetics and design, what each of these observers has highlighted is one of the many ways in which intangibles have come to dominate the marketplace. Of course, intangibles are nothing new, but nowadays intangibles dominate because more and more that is all that matters to us. In today's marketplace, material characteristics like reliability, comfort, convenience, performance, and functionality are taken for granted. Only intangibles make the difference that really matters to us. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our new podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter that recaps our discussion and provides links to our guests. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.